From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. And the week begins with an increase in the number of new U.S. cases of COVID-19, up 11% in the last 2 weeks, with New York and New Jersey back at the top of the list. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci on CBS.
What we're likely seeing is because of things like spring break and pulling back on the mitigation methods that you've seen now. Several states have done that. When you're coming down from a big peak and you reach a point and start to plateau, once you stay at that plateau, you're really in danger of a surge coming up. And unfortunately, that's what we're starting to see.
26 states are now showing those increases, 8 reporting a rise in deaths. Let's bring in now Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown University. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Jane.
So medical experts have been warning about the numbers starting to rise. I guess this shouldn't be a surprise, but how do you explain what's going on around the country right now?
Well, as you just said, I don't think it's a surprise. What Dr. Fauci was just saying is really what I and a lot of my colleagues have suspected might happen when some of these mitigation measures in many states were lifted. So prohibitions on indoor dining, on gyms, on businesses like that, the removal of mask mandates, the encouragement in general for people to start getting back together, especially in indoor environments, while vaccination is still sufficiently low that there are a lot of susceptible people in the population, is really a recipe for disaster. I really, really wish that many of these states had just held off a little bit longer before more people could get vaccinated before starting to open back up again.
But what about the role of the variants, specifically the UK variant? What role are they playing in this rise?
So I think that they are definitely playing a role. It's going to be different from community to community because there is a different level of those variants being present in those communities. But what we do know is that the B.1.1.7 variant that was first discovered in the UK is most definitely more transmissible than other variants that have been circulating. And lifting these mitigation measures just gives the variant more opportunity to spread within a population.
So let's talk about the virus spread among young people specifically. In Orange County, Florida, for example, people 45 and younger are now 1/3 of those hospitalized, and the average age of new infections is 30. Do you have a sense, doctor, of what's going on with this particular group?
Well, we've known for a while now, and we've seen this since last summer. For example, when there were universities reopening, we saw a spate of outbreaks that occurred in those environments. We know that young people can be a big driver of spread. What I think has been a large misconception throughout the pandemic is that young people never get sick from getting SARS coronavirus 2. As you just said, there are a number of younger people in the hospital. Death is not the only bad outcome of COVID-19. Even though younger people are less likely to die from it, they can still become very, very sick from it.
And you've written a lot about young people, Dr. Rasmussen, and you say that vaccinating kids might actually be the key to ending the pandemic. How so?
So, yes, my colleague Jeremy Faust and I have an editorial out in the New York Times today that is about that exact issue. I think a lot of people have been under the mistaken impression that children can't get SARS coronavirus 2 infection at all. The reality is children can definitely get it. They can transmit it to others. They just don't become as sick as often. They are often asymptomatic. But if we really, really want to control transmission, and there's also a great study out today from the CDC that shows that the vaccines are actually very effective in the real world against infection, we need to make sure that we're also vaccinating children. They're part of the population, and in order to get to that herd immunity threshold, we need the majority of people to be immunized so the virus can no longer spread through our population.
So to the vaccine rollout, then, the CDC says that 143 million doses have been put into people's arms so far. That's about 28% of Americans have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Half a dozen states are now offering it to anyone over 16, with more coming online this week. You must see these trends going in the right direction.
I do. And that is really the good news going forward. Even though we are seeing a surge in some states, and even though I wish that we had held off a little bit longer with these mitigation measures, I think that we are definitely going in the right direction in terms of vaccination. What I hope that the surge will will convince people of is that younger people or people who may think that they might not need to be vaccinated will be persuaded to actually get vaccinated. We will be able to really relax and feel like we are out of the woods once we have enough people that the virus is no longer capable of spreading through our population. And that means as many people who can be vaccinated should get vaccinated.
Before we go, Doctor, let me ask you for a moment about what we heard last night on CNN. They aired a documentary on the Trump administration's response to the pandemic, and I want to play a clip. Here's Dr. Deborah Birx, then a member of the president's task force.
There were about 100,000 deaths that came from that original surge. All of the rest of them, in my mind, could have been mitigated or decreased substantially.
About 30 seconds left here, Doctor. Dr. Birx said that about 450,000 deaths could have been prevented. Are we doing enough now with states imposing their own rules and some rules being relaxed?
Well, no, I don't think we're doing enough now. As I just said, I think that we're going in the right direction in terms of vaccination. But what people really, really should keep in mind is that until we reach that herd immunity threshold where the virus can no longer spread within our population, we still do need to be mindful and careful of reducing our exposure risk as much as possible. It's not just vaccination that's going to get us out of this, even though that is the long-term sustainable solution. We need to be doing other things as well to mitigate transmission until we can get everybody vaccinated.
That's Georgetown University virologist Dr. Angela Rasmussen. Dr. Rasmussen, thank you as always.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.
Well, there is a lot of cleanup and sadness today after torrential rainfall hit Nashville and Middle Tennessee over the weekend. At least four people died in flash flooding. 7 inches of rain fell on Nashville Saturday and Sunday. That is the city's second highest two-day rainfall total ever. And more than 100 people had to be rescued from flooded cars and homes in the Tennessee capital. WPLN reporter Nina Cardona joins us now. Nina, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
And the flooding was just the latest severe weather that hit your area over the weekend. There was lightning, tornadoes, and then the flash floods came. Walk us through what happened.
Well, rain from storms early that morning and a few days before had saturated the ground, and the rivers and the streams were already high. So then starting roughly a little before sundown on Saturday, the storms showed up on this path that ran right through the same areas again and again all night long into Sunday morning. And they just repeatedly hit all of those small waterways that were already full, so they just spilled over.
Did people have any warning?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Flash flood watches had been in place on and off for days because of all the weather we'd been having, so there was already that idea in place that you needed to be on the lookout for rising water. But with the way that the most intense part of this storm just battered particular danger zones again and again, it meant that in many spots, the water level ended up being so much more than people there might have anticipated based on previous flash flooding.
So what are you hearing from people about those rescues that I mentioned and how they escaped quite dramatically from their homes and their cars?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the number, we still don't have a total from the state yet. We do know that evacuations were carried out in half a dozen counties. In Nashville alone, there were 130 water rescues. One of those people is Corey Long, who one of our reporters met yesterday as he was cleaning out what he could rescue from the nursery that he and his wife had been preparing. She's 9 months pregnant.
One of us has got one dog, the other's got the other, and we're just kind of telling each other that we love each other, and it's terrible to talk about, honestly. It wasn't fun at all.
As you said, his wife was 9 months pregnant. The story goes that she was laying down in their guest room to get some rest when the water started gushing in around their doorframe. So that was incredibly dramatic, and I'm sure many people have stories like that. But Nina, how does this compare to the flooding that your area experienced back in 2010?
Well, the 2010 flood was just simply massive. This storm brought our second highest two-day rainfall total for Nashville. But 2010, which is the record, had twice as much rain, and it covered a much larger geographic area. There were also some complications then regarding dam releases that weren't an issue this time. But that said, while this is not on the same scale, it is a little different footprint. So there are some neighborhoods that took on more water this time, where this is the bigger disaster for those communities.
What's cleanup like? I understand your station was damaged as well.
Well, we had a lightning strike in an earlier storm, so we were already kind of in recovery mode before this rain even began. But, you know, as for the flooding, you know, thankfully the sun did come out yesterday morning, and that's a huge thing when you're dealing with flooding. So that after that night of rain, people were able to go ahead and start pulling everything out and clean and dry out and assess, and volunteers were able to mobilize right away. We should start hearing totals soon for the extent of the damage and whether or not there will be a disaster declaration to get FEMA involved, things of that nature.
Yeah, and just briefly, I mean, sometimes it's hard to gauge what morale in a city or a town is like after something like this, but Nashville has been through a lot lately, including that Christmas Day bombing in the city center.
Yeah, and tornadoes that happened a year ago this month that... You know, one thing that we've learned is that in the pandemic, recovery is slow. You know, things that should have happened recovering from last year's tornadoes still haven't happened.
Nina Cordona,
we'll just see how this goes.
Yeah. Nina Cordona, reporter from WPLN in Nashville. Thank you.
Thank you.
Witness testimony is now underway in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Chauvin has been charged with second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes during an arrest in May. George Floyd's death sparked an international protest movement over police brutality and racism, and much of the world will be paying attention to this trial. Joining us now is Eddie Glaude. He's professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Welcome back to Here and Now. It's good to speak with you.
Always a pleasure. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing all right. Thank you. And how are you today as we have one of the most high-profile trials in recent memory now underway?
You know, I'm on pins and needles. It's a kind of combination of grief, anticipation, and skepticism, and a kind of wariness, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Watching the death of George Floyd on video, as we have all done now, unfortunately, his neck under the knee of Derek Chauvin, that was traumatizing for many, many people. So how difficult do you think the trial will be for the American public as we all relive George Floyd's final moments?
Obviously for his family. It's going to be very difficult for young people around the country, for young people of color, particularly Black people. It will be difficult. I pray that for the nation more broadly, more generally, because we find ourselves in this very difficult moment. Think about this. The trial is beginning in the context of an all-out assault on voting rights, in the context of an escalation of violence against Asian Americans, in the context of the debates around immigration, against the backdrop of January 6th. In other words, it's taking place against the backdrop of an all-out panic about who we take ourselves to be in the country. You know, and people respond to panic and terror differently. So we'll see. We shall see.
Yeah. George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, spoke on NBC's Today Show this morning. Let's listen to that.
We know that this case, it, to us, is a slam dunk because we know the video is the proof. That's all you need. The guy was kneeling on my brother's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. A guy who was sworn in to protect. He killed my brother in broad daylight.
So George Floyd's family is projecting confidence there. But it is, as you well know, rare in this country for a police officer to be charged with murder, and even rarer to get a conviction. Do you share the family's confidence? Do you think this is a slam dunk case?
It should be, but I'm not confident it will be. You know, we are creatures of habit. Our experience has led us, has led me to believe that when police are charged in this sort of way for these sorts of crimes, they're rarely, if ever, convicted. And it has a lot to do with, you know, the standard of proof. It has a lot to do with qualified immunity, right? So I understand, I mean, because in some ways it's an assertion, right, what George Floyd's brother is saying. And that is, how can you not convict him when this is so clear? You see, that's the question, is how will you justify not convicting him when the evidence is so clear? And that question has always been asked with regards to Black lives in some ways.
It's a powerful question, isn't it?
I think so, you know, because it takes us to the heart of what what has in some ways organized this country since its founding. And that is that some people are valued more because of the color of their skin, while others have to experience a generalized sense of disregard because of the color of theirs.
Well, you hinted at the defense strategy earlier on in our conversation. As you say, they are likely, we know this, to be suggesting that George Floyd's death was caused from his drug use and his underlying health problems. They're going to try to sow doubt that the police officer's actions were the cause of this death. I guess that's a typical defense in a case like this, but your thoughts on that?
It is a typical defense. And in addition to that, they're going to say that he did not use excessive force, even though it is clear 8 minutes and 46 seconds is kind of a symbolic term, but we know that it was really 9 minutes and 30 seconds. So they're going to fall within the parameters of how police defend their actions. And again, the bar is very, very high. So the strange thing about it, though, is how familiar it all is. And that's the key, at least for me. Sometimes America, to echo James Baldwin, sometimes America resembles an exceedingly monotonous minstrel show. The same songs, the same jokes, the same dances. It feels as if we're in the middle of that theater right now.
I hear you say that, and I wonder if the American criminal justice system and the police on the issue of accountability have changed any in the last 10 months since George Floyd's death.
Not by the data. You know, COVID-19 didn't change the fact that, you know, police are still killing Black people at the same rates that they did pre-COVID. We still see 9-year-olds handcuffed. We see people with mental health episodes having to be buried by their parents. There's a general disregard, to my mind, for the value of Black life at times. And we've had to experience this haunting ritual for generations. So, you know, from whence one's faith that it will finally change? Well, you know, faith is oftentimes in the unseen. But we shall see. We shall see.
Eddie Glaude, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Eddie, thank you for your insights. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
NASA astronaut Mark Vandehei is getting ready for his second trip to the International Space Station. He and two Russian cosmonauts are scheduled to launch from Kazakhstan on Friday, April 9th. Vandehei completed his first space flight in 2018 after spending 168 days on the space station. This time he could be up there for twice as long. NASA gave us exactly 5 minutes with Mark Vandehei, who was on a phone line from Russia, and I started by asking him what the trip up to the space station would be like on board Russia's Soyuz spacecraft.
I'm expecting it to be surprisingly calm. A lot of our training involves everything possible going wrong. We get trained how to respond to all that, but we very rarely get to experience what the spaceflight will really be like, where the spacecraft works, ideally, will work just fine.
How long does it take to get up there?
Gosh, it takes about 8.5 minutes to actually get into orbit. For us, we'll get to the space station, if all works well, we'll get to the space station about 3 hours after launch.
So that's the way up. On the way back, you may have to give up your seat in the fall for this return flight to Earth because a Russian film crew will be on the space station making a movie, which means you may not get home until the spring of 2022. Are you okay with that, with spending a full year in space?
Well, I got to clarify that officially I am assigned to a 6-month flight, and we're always ready for things to change. As you mentioned, Roscosmos has a big say in how these seats work out. So if that ends up being the case, then certainly I'm ready for that as well. My perspective on it is, if I do end up staying in space for a year, that's a great deal for me. I I'm not certain that's going to happen, but if it ended up being the situation I'm in, I think it's a new opportunity, a new life experience that I've never had before.
I'll say. A few other Americans have made trips to space for over 300 days, so we have some information about what that's like, but what do you think it might do to your body if it ends up happening?
biggest concern I have is my bone density. I lost a lot of it. I lost 7% of it on the previous flight. And this time I'm going to try to do a better job of very carefully following the nutrition advice and the exercise advice that is on the plan to try to make sure I preserve it. So that's something that that took a while to recover. I got all that bone density back, but certainly spending more time in space, it has me having an even stronger desire to do all the right things to preserve that bone density.
Hmm. What do you think it would be like for human beings to make a much longer trip into space, say to Mars?
I think it's going to be very challenging, physically and psychologically. We've got a lot to learn before you can do that. The length of the flight will be a challenge, but you can imagine when we look at Mars right now, you can pick out this star, of course it's a planet, that looks slightly red, and that's how we identify Mars, also knowing exactly where it would be. Imagine what it would be like, though, looking back, the place where all the people you love, your entire life history before that time, looking back, and it just looks like a faint blue star out there in this vast field of other stars. So I think that's going to be hard for humans to be that far away from home.
Do you think we'll do it anyway?
Oh, of course. I absolutely believe that. We've taken lots of risks. We've even crossed the Atlantic or Pacific to get to new places. Those have involved tremendous risks. We've still done them, and I'm sure we'll do them again.
Before I let you go, what's it like to live at the International Space Station, and how do you get used to just a very odd living environment, and not to mention just tight quarters and weightlessness?
The tight quarters wasn't really a big deal for me. It certainly is an indoor job. I kind of jokingly call it a fantastic science lab in the basement with a beautiful view of the Alps behind the boiler. So when you get a chance to look out the window, you cannot get a better view than that spot. But it's not your normal work environment. But the space station has the internal volume of a six-bedroom house. So there's plenty of space. The only time it's very constrained space is for me on the trip up in that Soyuz. I'll be sitting in a almost kind of a fetal position. And there's not a lot of extra space in there at all. It's a very efficient little spacecraft.
Mark van de Hei, astronaut on his way to the International Space Station. Good luck. Stay safe.
Thank you very much, Peter. Great talking to you today.
You too.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Now that the COVID-19 vaccine pipeline is flowing more smoothly and rapidly, the Biden administration is launching initiatives to promote shots to those who might be reluctant to get them. According to an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll released this month, 49% of Republican men say they will refuse to be vaccinated, including 47% who supported Donald Trump in 2020 and 38% of white evangelical Christians. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll joins us with the details. And John, this is a pretty specific audience to target, isn't it?
It certainly is, Jane. There are two initiatives the White House is launching, according to Wall Street Journal reports. The first one goes right to the heart of that conservative audience. Biden administration officials are partnering with the Christian Broadcasting Network, NASCAR, some country music organizations to reach those groups with their message. In addition, the nonprofit Ad Council has produced a series of PSAs that will run on TV and digital platforms with time donated by a variety of media organizations. Mm.
And as you mentioned, this ad campaign contains an important outreach to evangelicals. One PSA is called Worship, and it has a clear religious message. Let's take a listen.
We all want to get back to how we pray. how we congregate. How we lift our voices in praise. Now it's time to take the first step that lets us get back to spreading the word without spreading concern.
So the ad goes on to say it's okay to have questions like, should I get the vaccine? Is it safe? Should I wait? But oddly, it doesn't answer the questions. It just sends people to a website. So I think it would have been more effective if they had given some really concise answers to that.
Well, the centerpiece of the Ad Council campaign is a television spot featuring an old standard that Willie Nelson turned into a sort of post-pandemic anthem. It plays against a backdrop of sporting events taking place in front of sold-out crowds in stadiums and arenas and ballparks. It's interesting. Let's take a listen.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through.
How'd that spot come about, John?
Well, the Ad Council teamed up with this group called the COVID Collaborative, which is a group of health and economic and education professionals. And what they did was they went to 13 different sports leagues and organizations and said, you know, can we put this thing together? So they had a lot of cooperation. They have a lot of scenes, crowds applauding and cheering. And basically it is a flashback to what used to be. And I think that, you know, what it's trying to say is the vaccine is coming. We'll see you soon.
About 20 seconds, John. There are two initiatives. What's the other one, quickly?
The other one is a $1.5 billion initiative from the White House. It's going to be very much a community-level outreach. There's not going to be any national advertising, no administration figures. It's going to be very much targeted to groups who are vaccine skeptics.
Interesting. John Carroll is media analyst for Here and Now. John, thanks. As food editor of the New York Times and co-founder of the wildly popular New York Times Cooking, Sam Sifton knows a lot about what America cooks and how. In the past few years, Sifton has become a proponent of what he calls no-recipe recipes, so much so that he's just written a book about it, aptly titled The New York Times Cooking, No-Recipe Recipes. And he joins me now. Sam, welcome back to Here and Now. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
So where'd this idea come from, the no-recipe recipe?
Well, it came from a number of different directions all at once and slowly, if that's possible. The fact of the matter is, I spend a lot of time with recipes, right? And I spend a lot of time thinking about how to make bad recipes into good recipes or unhelpful recipes into helpful recipes. But at the same time, I realize I spend a lot of time talking with people about food and telling them how to make something. And when we do that, we don't really talk about specific amounts or oven temperatures. It's a hot oven, a medium oven, a low oven. It's a fistful of mint rather than three tablespoons or what have you. And I thought to myself, you know, I might want to bring a little bit of that into the newsletter that I write for NYT Cooking, What to Cook, as a way of kind of offering a new way of thinking about food so that you don't have to always follow a recipe. You can kind of riff on something as a kind of improvisation rather than following the sheet music really closely. And I did that on Wednesdays for a bunch of years. And then some smart cookie was like, maybe we should put this together in a book.
Take us through one of your no-recipe recipes and tell us how your instructions then differ from what we may be used to seeing.
Well, sure, I can do that. I've got a no-recipe recipe here for a kale salad with cranberries, pecans, and blue cheese. You make a mustardy vinaigrette that'll stand up to the greens. That's mustard, it's olive oil, a little lemon juice, salt, and pepper. And you drizzle that over some stemmed and chopped kale. And then you put in some, like, big flavored mix-ins. That could be anything. I use dried cranberries and some pecans. And then I put in some crumbled blue cheese and some croutons because it's sweet, it's salty, it's spicy, it's sour. And then I serve it with some red wine. Why don't we eat salads for dinner more often? That's all you got to do.
So people think you were just telling me that, but you were actually reading that because I was reading along with you. Page 66. That was
there
the
you
recipe.
Go.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the recipe, but it doesn't have to be the recipe. You could put dried currants in there instead of the cranberries. You could use a different kind of nut. You could use a different kind of cheese. You can make the meal however you want to make the meal.
Yeah.
And I think that it's neat to tell people that they can do that now because most of us have been cooking more over the course of the past year than we ever have cooked in our lives. So I think kitchen confidence is up a little, and I hope that a book like No Recipe Recipes can reward that confidence with some ideas for what to do with your skills.
So here's another one, rotisserie chicken panzanella. And here is your recipe. Tear a rotisserie chicken into strips and pieces, then cut a few smallish supermarket tomatoes, or better ones if you've got them, into wedges and marinate them in olive oil, salt, pepper, and red wine vinegar. Pay a few bills or fold some laundry and then turn the whole thing into panzanella by mixing together the chicken, tomatoes, some watercress, and several handfuls of croutons. Shower the salad with pepper and add a spray of salt. This, too, is cooking.
Yes, that's a good salad.
That is a good. Well, I got to tell you, I made the roasted cauliflower soup because I had a head of cauliflower and I thought, okay, I'm going to try it out. Sam says I can do this. And sure enough, I did not have artichokes. And so I used hearts of palm. And
oh, cool.
It was pretty good. I have to say it was pretty good.
That's cool. I love it with the hearts of palm. What a neat idea.
So you just said that cooking without a recipe is like musical improvisation, a skill, right? I mean, a lot of people will say, well, it's hard to trust yourself, you know, and you don't want to mess up a good dish. To mm-hmm. which you say what, Sam Sifton?
Well, what I say to that is you're probably not going to mess it up. What we're doing here is roasting, we're steaming, we're boiling, we're braising, we're grilling. All those things are like, that's at the base. We know how to do that. And we've been doing it, as I say, for a year now straight.
Mm-hmm.
And then to build flavors, we're just making little triangles of sweet, salty, and fiery, or sour and umami-ish and bitter. And you just kind of play things off one another in ways that are pleasing to you.
Mm. So you don't need a recipe, but you do need a pantry, which you say right in the beginning of the book. And you have a list of essentials, things like onions and flour and cornstarch and butter and dried fruits. What ingredients are at the top of that list for you, Sam, as far as pantry items that you really need to keep stocked?
For me, the most important thing is to have a lot of condiments because mm-hmm. condiments help deliver flavor. So that could be as simple as hot sauce. It could be gochujang, the Korean hot pepper mm-hmm. sauce. I mean, sauce, paste. It could be a flavored oil, like a sesame oil is a good thing to have. You should always have some anchovies on hand, tomato paste on hand. You should always have soy sauce on hand. You should maybe always have fish sauce on hand, mm-hmm. depending on what direction your cooking goes. I find that having a stocked pantry makes it unbelievably easy to riff because you can, if you think, oh, I need something salty, you can go to those anchovies. If I need something sweet, I can make a decision. Maybe I'll use this molasses. Maybe I'll use maple syrup. Maybe I'll use honey.
And like you say, it seems that pantry cooking is what we've been doing. A lot of us have been doing for the past year. You know, how can I cook this can of beans differently tonight? Right.
Right. I mean, that's right.
So what other shifts in cooking habits have you seen over the past year at New York Times Cooking?
One of the things that I've noticed is that I think I have a suspicion that portion size is coming down for a lot of people.
Mm.
I mean, there are a lot of people who spent a lot of the pandemic alone or with yeah. one or two other people. And they have no use of a giant vat of stew or beans. So they're looking for smaller serving sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's that may ultimately be a good thing for our readers' health, that we're eating a little less. I certainly don't miss it.
What else is in your mailbox, Sam Sifton? I mean, what other kinds of recipes would you say readers are calling for these days?
Well, there's an overwhelming desire for, and I realize this may contradict what I just said a little bit, but an overwhelming desire for comfort. We're hurting now at the tail end of this thing, even as maybe because there's some hope on the horizon and we're still stuck here. And the recipes that people are asking for don't necessarily reflect that so much as they reflect a desire to feel loved, to feel taken care of, to feel nourished. Mm-hmm. So those stews, smaller but still stews, mm-hmm. those braises, smaller but still braised and delicious, big flavors, sauces, and the like.
A quick shout out to those people who are just flat tired of cooking during the pandemic, Sam. I mean, to those people, you say what? That must happen to you too.
Oh, absolutely. And what I say often is give yourself a break, order a pizza, and try as much as possible to make the act of cooking an intentional one that brings joy into your life as opposed to drudgery into your life.
And so as we're slowly opening up after the pandemic, do you see people still cooking, still going at it in the kitchen?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I think that one thing that people have learned a lot about over the course of the past year is food cost. And they see that by cooking at home, they're saving money and they're making the flavors that they want. You can roast an excellent chicken at home in about the time that it takes to go get one elsewhere, and more cheaply, too. And I think that'll keep people cooking. And I think people have learned that they like to cook. And I think that'll keep them cooking as well.
New York Times food editor Sam Sifton's new book is The New York Times Cooking No Recipe Recipes. Sam, as always, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure to be here. I'm glad you liked the book.
The CDC released a report today with more good news about two of the leading coronavirus vaccines. Pfizer and Moderna's mRNA vaccines reduced the risk of infection by 80% after the first dose and 90% following the second dose, according to new data, which comes from a study of nearly 4,000 frontline workers. What's more, it found those vaccines were effective at stopping infections altogether, not just symptomatic disease. That is a significant development for the progress of the synthetic mRNA technology behind those vaccines, which has been described as a medical breakthrough that could have implications far beyond the pandemic. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's been writing about this. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, and you know, we've been learning about Pfizer and Moderna's mRNA vaccines for months now, but the way that you described how they actually work in your most recent piece really hit home. You said the core principle is tantalizingly simple, even beautiful. The world's most powerful drug factory might be inside all of us. Tell us more about that.
That's right. So people rely on proteins for just about every bodily function. And the recipe book for our proteins is mRNA. Now, what these medicines do, what these treatments do, is that they make synthetic mRNA that essentially commandeers our cellular machinery to make just about any protein under the sun. In this case, the protein that we want to make is the distinctive spike protein on the coronavirus. So the mRNA vaccines send detailed instructions to our cells to produce this distinctive spike protein. Our immune system sees these spike proteins, targets them for destruction, and in the process learns how to recognize and how to target spike proteins that might arrive with the actual coronavirus. So that if we get infected with or if we are exposed to the coronavirus in the future, Our immune system remembers exactly how it dealt with the coronavirus spike protein that was synthesized by the vaccines. It targets that protein, destroys it, and thus destroys the virus itself. These are essentially little miracle vaccines that do use our own cellular machinery to produce the outcome that is vaccination.
It is also the first time mRNA vaccines have been approved for use, but the history of the technology goes back several decades, and there were many who thought this would just never work. So how did we get here to this point?
It's an amazing long story, and there are so many different heroes here, but let me call out a few. One is in the 1970s, Katalin Karikó, a Hungarian scientist who was one of the first people in the world to begin researching mRNA. For years, for decades, she struggled to make it work until she finally had a breakthrough in the early 2000s with her partner, Drew Weissman. And they found a way to design synthetic mRNA that our cells wouldn't immediately destroy. So you could get that information inside of the cell. That paper caught the attention of U.S. researchers who went on to form the company Moderna. It caught the attention of German researchers who went on to form the company BioNTech. And of course, the two mRNA vaccines that have been authorized by the U.S. are produced by Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech. So it's really remarkable the degree to which a basic scientific research planted the seed that grew into the tree that became mRNA vaccines.
Well, and now scientists are trying to use that same technology to find a solution for malaria and even the seasonal flu. So what's the potential?
The potential is that, very simply stated, the benefit of mRNA is that you can synthesize it very quickly and that it's a very nimble technology. So I spoke to one person out of Yale who is designing an RNA therapy to essentially fight back against malaria, which might be the most devastating and diabolical disease in the world. Malaria kills more than 400,000 people every year, and it's not a virus or a bacteria. It's a disease that once you catch it, your body struggles to develop protection against it going forward, unlike a lot of viruses that we experience here. And so it's so important to be able to design a sneakier, more nimble vaccine that can essentially design a protein that is found on the malaria organism. So that's one thing that I looked at and wrote about in the article. And then also Pfizer is looking at adapting its success against the coronavirus to develop mRNA vaccines against influenza, against seasonal flu as well.
So we have less than a minute here, but we need to be careful not to overpromise. Explain why we should be cautious about the future of mRNA vaccines.
I think it's a great question. I'm optimistic about the future of mRNA vaccines, but this is just a little story that goes to show that you can't always say that today's breakthrough will be sort of tomorrow's miracle drug. In March 2020, there were a lot of really brilliant vaccinologists who said the company that was going to win the race against COVID-19 was Merck. It had recently developed this beautiful vaccine against Ebola using a technology called VSV, a vesicular stomatitis virus. But that did not work. And so just as Merck couldn't use its success from its last effort into coronavirus, we shouldn't be too confident that mRNA is the only vaccine technology that will work going forward.
Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.